KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Shea Stevens. Investigators have retrieved the flight recorders from the Army helicopter and regional passenger jet that crashed over the Potomac River near Washington, D.C. Efforts continue to recover all 67 victims of the tragedy. NPR's Frank Langford reports from Reagan National Airport.
Military helicopters are a common sight in the skies around Washington. At a news conference, National Transportation Safety Board member Todd Inman explained how they navigate the crowded airspace here.
They're actually helicopter zones, if you will, or tracks. And this one was transiting, I believe, from track 1 to 4 as part of their normal procedure.
Inman said the aircraft's recording devices should provide their altitude when they collided, an important piece of data as investigators try to figure out what led to the crash that left 67 people dead. Frank Langford, NPR News, Reagan National.
The National Science Foundation has halted funding for existing research grants. As Jonathan Lambert reports, the move comes amid efforts to comply with President Trump's executive orders.
Hundreds of scientists who receive direct funding from NSF for their livelihoods are unable to get paid right now, and the research funds that go to institutions and universities are in limbo. NSF is congressionally mandated to consider how its grants will boost underrepresented groups' participation in science. That mandate is at odds with Trump's executive orders aiming to terminate diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts across the government. The National Science Foundation has an annual budget of around $9 billion to fund research grants. Payments of those grants have been paused since Tuesday as the agency reviews their grant making and the projects they fund. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
President Trump's nominee to head the FBI appeared at his Senate confirmation hearing today. Kash Patel is a critic of federal law enforcement and says he wants to focus on fighting terrorism and drug trafficking. As NPR's Kerry Johnson reports, Senate Democrats were concerned about Patel's support for some of the rioters who stormed the U.S. Capitol in January 2021.
Patel helped promote a song by what's been called the J6 Choir. That's a group of rioters who had been detained in the same D.C. jail. Patel is actually listed as a promoter of the choir, and at least 5 of the members pleaded guilty to attacking police. One of them sprayed Officer Brian Sicknick with chemicals. That officer died the next day after suffering a stroke.
NPR's Gary Johnson reporting. Democrats on the Senate Intelligence Committee today grilled Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's nominee to become Director of National Intelligence. Gabbard was questioned about her support for then-Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad and former national security analyst Edward Snowden, who leaked classified information on global surveillance program. Snowden now lives in Russia. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 168 points. This is NPR News. NASA astronauts Suni Williams and Butch Wilmore did some maintenance work today outside the International Space Station. They've been stranded aboard the outpost because of technical issues found during their arrival aboard Boeing's Starliner spacecraft nearly 8 months ago. NASA says the pair are now expected to return to Earth in late March or early April. President Trump has ordered FCC Chief Brendan Carr to investigate NPR and PBS over the underwriting spots aired on stations across the nation. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, Carr says the spots are too much like commercials.
The Federal Communications Commission actually doesn't regulate the networks. It regulates public broadcasting stations because the agency licenses them to use the public airwaves. In separate statements, the chief executives of PBS and NPR say they're careful to observe the law and agency regulations and have followed the FCC's own guidance for decades. Carr wrote in his letter to the networks that he was sharing his decision to launch the inquiry with lawmakers on Capitol Hill in hopes it helps convince them to cut off funds for the public broadcasters. President Trump's repeated proposals to do just that proved unsuccessful in his first term. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
British pop icon Marianne Faithfull has died in London. Faithfull's hits include the 1964 song As Tears Go By, written by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. She recorded dozens of songs over a career that lasted nearly six decades, including The Ballad of Lucy Jordan, which was featured as a soundtrack in the Hollywood movie Thelma and Louise. Faithfull was 78. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
UFOs are in the news and in the sky again. We label any object cruising the skies that we can't identify as an unidentified flying object. And the term UFO applies to some surprising sightings in New Jersey.
I was driving home from a friend's house and I saw a drone that looked like the size of a small car just hovering right above the golf course. And I tried to get a picture of it, but you know how it is, the lights, it's kind of hard to get a true image out of it.
The moving lights in the sky had some Garden State residents alarmed. The reports increased, and at some point it seemed everyone in the area was seeing these objects, many which were thought to be drones. And then the questions began flying. Were the objects military drones or something else? And why did it all feel so menacing? Well, we now have some answers.
While this frenzy may not seem like your typical UFO story, it has a lot in common with the long history of UFO sightings. Welcome to Big Picture Science. I'm Seth Shostak.
I'm Molly Bentley. In this, our regular look at critical thinking skeptic check, we help make sense of the drone panic.
We'd like to begin with a story that unfolded seven decades ago on the West Coast.
In 1954, something strange happened in Bellingham, Washington. Residents began noticing dings in their car windshields. You know, those pits from errant rocks or hail. People said that they had appeared suddenly. The reports multiplied. Drivers began stopping the police to show the damage done to their cars. As the wave of windshield pitting spread, people suggested what might be the cause. They included vandalism, cosmic rays, even fallout from nuclear tests. One idea was charmingly odd. Some thought sand fleas were laying eggs in the glass.
And curiously, the pitting never occurred to the side windows of cars or to windows of homes. In just 2 weeks, the tally of reports had grown to 3,000 and now included some from neighboring Seattle. Officials had no convincing explanation, and public disquiet grew. The mayor of Bellingham appealed to the state governor, and then to President Eisenhower for help. This event became known as the Seattle windshield pitting epidemic.
You might be asking what the sudden appearance of windshield dings in 1954 has in common with the 2024 drone sightings in New Jersey. We'll hear later how the windshield incident was resolved. In November of 2024, people began reporting strange lights moving in the sky over New Jersey. Over the next few weeks, the frequency of reports increased. Many believed the lights were drones. Some found the whole event mysterious, others found it funny. But some, like New York Congresswoman Nicole Malliotakis, were genuinely unsettled by the appearance of unidentified objects in our airspace.
So it is concerning, particularly over an area like New York City, so densely populated, that we have so many of these drones. There could be an accident, there could be a crash, there could be a lithium battery issue. We are very concerned about the safety, and we expect the government to have answers for us on what this is.
But let's step back. After all, we don't always know what we're looking at, although we may think we do. So to understand these weird phenomena, let's begin by drawing on the experience of someone who studies the sky for a living.
Hi, I'm Andrew Fracknoy, and I'm the professor of astronomy at the Fromm Institute at the University of San Francisco.
I'm originally from the East Coast, so let's begin by getting the obligatory New Jersey joke out of the way.
Andy, what went through your head when you first heard that there were unusual drone sightings over New Jersey?
Well, as an old New Yorker, of course, the first thing I said is, of course, over New Jersey.
Although, as we'll hear, the Garden State may have been the ideal location for this phenomenon, but not for the reasons New Yorkers would like to think. For now, let's forget about it. Professor Andy Fracknoy says he wasn't surprised that lights in the sky caused a public stir.
We have a long history in the United States of people seeing something in the sky, then other people latching onto that story, and suddenly there's a whole public uproar about something in the sky that seems mysterious. But generally, they all turn out to be something quite ordinary, either in the sky or from planet Earth.
Do we ever have it around astronomical phenomena?
Well, there are many people who misinterpret astronomical phenomena as lights in the sky they can't explain. The classic story is the late President Jimmy Carter, who was a wonderful man in so many ways. But in 1969, Jimmy Carter went to a service club meeting. He was then governor of Georgia, and he saw inside of the twilight sky a bright light that seemed to be approaching him. And being a careful and sober man, he recorded the position, the direction. He noted it with other people. There is some sort of mysterious light in the sky. Later, when this was published, he actually sent it to a UFO bureau in Oklahoma. When this was all published, astronomers went back and looked to see what might have been in the sky right at that time, and it turned out to be the planet Venus. And the planet Venus, which is often a brilliant evening star or morning star, is perhaps the most misinterpreted astronomical object. There are stories of recruits in the military trying to shoot down Venus as an approaching enemy plane. But it just turned out to be Venus for the future president as well. And we're getting some reports now that some of the drones in New Jersey, some of the pictures that have been reported, were actually of the bright planet Venus in the evening sky.
Andy, I wonder if you could just describe what the lights look like. Did people see small dots of lights, white lights, blinking lights? What were they seeing?
People saw a wide range of different lights, and that also contributed to the mystery that they weren't all the same. Some lights, as you say, were just pinpoints of light. Others were groups of lights, some colored, some not. Some of the lights were mysteriously still and not moving, and others seemed to be moving at what the observer interpreted to be very significant speed. Now, it's very hard from the ground to estimate the speed of something in the sky unless you also know its distance, because how fast something will seem to be moving depends a lot on how far away it is. So there were interpretations of these lights that said they were moving at rates that were just unbelievable, and others that said, oh, the lights were just so still, it seemed menacing. And you have to remember that New Jersey has a major international airport, Newark Airport, into which planes fly and out of which planes come. And if you are in the right part of New Jersey, you are likely to see moving lights in the sky relatively low as airplanes come in and go out of Newark Airport.
Why do you think people didn't identify them as planes? Why did they think they were drones?
No one's saying that there weren't any drones. It's just that the discussion of drones then started to convert airplanes, planets, stars into drones, rather than limiting the drones to the ones that actually were drones.
I see. Well, here's a good example of that. The ex-governor of Maryland, Larry Hogan, reported a number of drones, a cluster of drones over his house. Did you hear this, what the story of
this is? This is a great story. So yes, the former governor, Larry Hogan, reported that he had seen drones in formation. They weren't flying very fast. They were staying, sort of hovering in one place, and they had this unusual formation where there were three in a line.
Kind of like a belt?
Yes, like a belt, you might say. And if you know the sky, if you are an amateur astronomer, you may be familiar with the bright constellation of Orion, the Hunter, which has three stars in a belt and a bright star above and a bright star below. And so it's pretty clear now from a discussion of where the ex-governor saw this formation of drones that he was really looking at the constellation of Orion.
I want to pick up on that point that some of these lights look like they were hovering or still. Of course, in the case of Orion, there are a certain set of circumstances there that explain that. But as for the other lights, Andy, isn't there a phenomenon called the parallax view, which makes objects look like, in the example of planes, they're hovering or they're not moving? Could you describe that for us?
Right. So parallax is when we can measure for a star how it's moving across the line of sight, but we don't know what's called the proper motion, which is the moving toward us or away from us. We have to measure that by using the Doppler shifts and things like that. So when you look at something in the sky, a light in the sky, it's very difficult to estimate the exact speed at which it's moving. For example, if something is moving directly away from you or toward you, it doesn't look like it's moving across the sky. It may just get dimmer or look like it's gone because it's moved away from you. Whereas if something is moving in a path which is directly across your line of sight, then it will look like it's moving across the sky. And most objects move in both directions, both in the away from you and toward you direction and the across the sky direction. And unless you know how they're located, where they're located, and how exactly their flight path is, you don't estimate very accurately the physical speed of the objects. Things can look like they're moving faster or slower than they really are, unless you have some sense of their location. The other thing about looking in the sky is that it's not always entirely clear. There can be turbulence in the air, there can be clouds, even subtle clouds. Things can wink in and out because of the unsteadiness of the atmosphere. That's why stars twinkle, because the light from distant stars goes through quite a bit of the Earth's atmosphere, some of which is moving, some of which has a particulate matter in it. And so it's all making the interpretation much more confusing for an inexperienced person.
There are many different kinds of drones, and they come in all different sizes. And some of the bigger drones that I saw, have seen, are about 2 feet across. But Andy, people reported seeing drones the size of cars. And this is a subcategory of the answer you just gave us, or of the question I asked you. But why are we so poor at estimating the size, not only the movement, but the size of objects? Why might we think that a drone looks like the size of a car when it's just a couple feet across?
Or equivalently, why do people see a giant airplane and interpret it to be a drone, which is, as you said, quite small? It's because we really don't know the size of something in the sky until we know how far away it is. And that's what I think has confused a number of well-meaning observers. there was a story back, I think, even in the 50s, of lights in the sky in Texas. There was a town in Texas where all of a sudden there weren't just lights in the sky that couldn't be interpreted, but swarms of them, great swarms flying overhead. And not just one night, but several times people saw this. They called into radio stations, and there was just tremendous public concern about some sort of, in those days, it would have been airplanes from another country or an enemy power. 1950s were a time when we were very worried about the Russians and the communist menace. And only later did it become clear what had happened. There had been an oil slick near the town, and a number of birds had landed, unfortunately, in that oil and then had flown away. And as a swarm of birds with oil on their bellies flew over the lights of the town, their bellies became much more reflective than bird bellies usually were. And that was the swarm of lights. It was a poor set of oily birds reflecting the lights of the town. But there was a great deal of hysteria about this until the answer came in. And there are still people who don't believe that it was birds, who think that the government is covering up some kind of deep mystery. I'll say one other thing about scientists, though. It's fascinating that there have been many surveys done of who sees UFOs. And you'd imagine that there were two populations of people who would be especially prone to see alien spaceships that are visiting our planet. And that would be the amateur astronomers who observe the sky as a hobby, and the professional astronomers who observe the sky as a job. And yet when you survey them, they very rarely or mostly never see a UFO. That's because they know what they're looking for and what they're looking at in the sky. Whereas the average person who doesn't know the sky is much more likely to report a UFO.
Andy Fracknoy, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Good to be with you.
Andrew Fracknoy is a professor of astronomy at the Fromm Institute at the University of San Francisco.
You know, Andy's story about the oil slick birds got me thinking how fun it would be to have to write the headlines for a story like that. Like, I don't know, birds of a feather slick together, or oil vey.
Well, I think my headline would be Oil Mythology Visible in the Night Skies.
So that's oil anthology instead of ornithology?
Oil mythology, yes. And the oil anthology is the history of the petroleum business, I guess.
Next, how many of the objects flying over New Jersey were ultimately identified?
If you have the date, the time, the location, and the direction, what you can do is you can look up what would be in the air at that time.
We're looking at what caused drone panic on this episode of Skeptic Check from Big Picture Science.
Drone sightings in New Jersey provoked a great deal of interest from the public. Some people were amused, others were alarmed. State and national representatives told reporters that they wanted answers. New York Representative Nicole Malliotakis suggested to CNN's Jake Tapper that the government might deliberately be withholding information.
Honestly, we just want the truth. We just want the government to tell us what they know. I find it very hard to believe that our government, with its intelligence, its military capabilities, does not know what's going on here. And if the truth is they don't, then we have a much bigger problem right now.
Before experts could weigh in on what they knew, she and other officials were floating their own ideas about what the objects were.
Personally, I think it's potentially our own government that may be doing some surveillance or counterterrorism, but then be honest.
Do you, for that the theory you just posited, that it's our own government doing some anti-terrorism work, is that just a theory? Do you have any evidence for that? What's the reason for that suspicion?
You know, it's actually my hope that that's what it is. It's our own government.
Other officials, such as Michael Mellum, mayor of Bellevue, New Jersey, were confident what the objects were not.
We know for a fact that these things are not operating the way airplanes do. Airplanes tend to glide and go from point A to point B in a direct line. These things are going up and down in elevation. They're hovering. They're moving erratically. These things are not manned aircraft. That's insulting to be told that.
All this speculation helped the drone story take off. Collecting evidence to explain the odd phenomena took a little longer to get off the ground.
My name is Mick West, and I investigate strange things such as conspiracy theories and UFOs.
Mick explained to producer Brian Edwards how officials determine the identity of many of the objects, the role of the media and human nature in fomenting drone panic, and why we might need to adjust to the presence of drones, because they have become popular. But drones were only part of the story.
Drones actually represent like a whole bunch of different things. Basically, a drone just means an unmanned aircraft. People were reporting seeing what they described as car-sized drones, which is quite a spectacular claim, really, because car-sized drones are actually very, very rare. Most drones that you would see in the night sky would be these smaller drones, and you're not going to actually see a car-sized drone. So what people actually were seeing there were lights in the sky, and they were reporting seeing basically configurations of lights that they didn't recognize, and they interpreted those lights as being drones.
So I'm Brian in Brooklyn. I go outside, I look up in the sky, there are no stars here, you know, so I see three lights in the sky and I'm like, wow, that is very odd. Who do we report this to? Who looks into something that we're seeing in the sky to figure out what that is?
Well, when the public is seeing things in the sky, nobody really wants to handle that, because you get this huge influx of reports from the public, and they're usually very low-quality reports. Now, say if a craft did fly over downtown Manhattan, you would expect to see hundreds, if not thousands, of reports, and that would be something that would get the attention of the authorities. That would be something that would be the purview of the Department of Homeland Security, because that's something that's a domestic possible terrorist threat or something that's interfering with our airspace. So it would be DHS and the FAA, because the FAA controls the airspace. When we talk about reports of drones now, what we're talking about is largely social media. The public will post something on social media, and then perhaps a news outlet might pick that up, and then they would report it on the news.
Mick, it seems to me in these cases that people are posting unverified claims online, and there's a bit of a straight line right to news organizations covering those stories and amplifying that information that they're putting out. Is that the case here?
Yeah, very much so. The media has a lot of responsibility for this story, like getting to where it is. It's really a kind of a feedback loop. It started out relatively small, like several weeks before it got into this mainstream media thing, Then you get things like local news reporting on it, and that drives more public interest, and then you get the mainstream media eventually comes in. But then, because it becomes a big news story, they're kind of desperate for footage, and so they'll pretty much put anything up on the screen that someone has said is actually a drone. So you see these ridiculous news stories where in the background there's a loop of this footage, and it's just stuff that's obviously planes. Some of them you can even see like the wings and the lights and everything. So the media is in the hunger for a story has actually created a story.
It did, get very big on the news, it got big online, and officials eventually did respond to these sightings, at least in some way. Can you kind of summarize what the word was about what they said these lights in the sky were?
their official word on it was that basically they were getting lots of reports, which means that, you know, they were hearing that people were seeing these things in the sky, they were seeing them on the news, other people were like sending things in. And later they actually issued statements saying, you know, what we've looked into this, and the vast majority of these reports appear to just be misidentifications of domestic drones or airplanes, which is actually the majority of what these things turned out to be. And they said there's no actual cause for alarm, there's no apparent security threat, and there's really nothing to worry about, which of course doesn't make people happy. Everyone's getting all worried, and then the officials say there's nothing to worry about. That just makes them even more suspicious.
So it seems like you've hit on a key point of this story here, which is that once official sources put out information saying that, you know, this is nothing to worry about, that actually has the opposite effect. That is throwing gasoline on this fire, and it takes off after that. Why is that?
Well, we're living in a time where people are very suspicious of official sources. And there's also, you know, the idea that people know what they saw. They don't like to be told that they didn't see what they think they saw. So if someone goes out there and they think they saw a drone, and then they hear there's an official story where they're saying, oh, you're just seeing airplanes. If you can't actually demonstrate to that person that they saw an airplane, they just hear someone saying, you didn't see what you thought you saw, like, you know, the evidence of your own eyes isn't valid. And so they will naturally push back against that. So you've got this natural zeitgeist where people are suspicious of authority, and you've got people who are desperately looking for validation of what they thought they saw, which, and those two things together, means that when someone says there's nothing to see here, don't worry about it, it just makes things worse.
Can you kind of go through and lay out, you know, some of the cases that you've looked at and what, you know, what evidence you've seen for these sightings in the sky?
Well, we got a lot of cases. I'm on social media, and I have this website, Metabunk, where we have a Skydentify forum where we look into these things. And so when we see an interesting one, we'll try to figure out what it is. The vast majority of the things that got posted on social media were just little videos of lights in the sky with no real context. It's very difficult to do anything than say that looks like a plane. And, you know, for the most matter, it did actually look like planes. However, there are a number of cases where they were post the video, they'd also post where they were and what time it was and what direction they were looking in. So if you have those things, the date, the time, the location, and the direction, what you can do is you can look up what would be in the air at that time. And you can use these online sites like Flight Radar 24 or ADS-B Exchange to basically rewind the positions of the planes to where they were. And then I wrote some custom software where I can put the camera in a certain position where the person would be looking and just recreate the video. And we were able to do that with pretty much all of the cases where we had that daytime and location. And it was invariably something like a plane or a helicopter, or in a couple of cases it was some stars or some planets. But people were posting things without the information, and that's where the kind of the mystery arises, in this low information zone.
Not just people posting either, you know, there were even politicians, you know, going on the news or posting things online, and it seemed like the evidence was quite weak for what they're saying, despite the big claims of spy planes or other nefarious things like that.
Yeah, there was a senator, Andy Kim, who was actually one of the few people who did actually first make the mistake, and he first thought there was something up in the sky, and then he posted about it online, but then he did actually take the time to listen to what people were telling him and actually investigate what he was actually looking at, and do it with the actual details of, you know, the date, time, and location, these technical things, which are perhaps a little boring. He actually took that step to actually do that. A lot of people do not do that. They just say, I know what I saw. I saw things in the sky. A lot of what you get in the New Jersey and New York area is private jets, and there's a lot of a lot of rich people in that area, and there's a lot of people fly private jets, and they're often going to non-standard airports, like smaller airports, and they come in fairly low, and people don't recognize them. They're used to seeing, you know, regular big old planes, but when they see these private jets, they look odd because they have different lighting configurations. They're a bit smaller. Their engines are at the back, and the wings are further back, and the lights sometimes illuminate the body in a certain way. So you get these unusual planes, which you have a lot more of in that area, which kind of made New Jersey the ideal breeding ground for this story.
So, Mick, let's say we have a case where, you know, we've used these tools at our disposal. We have figured out that it is not a plane. It's not Venus or another planet. It's not a constellation of stars that we're seeing. Can we automatically assume that that's a drone? How do we figure out if it is a drone?
Well, drones exist. I mean, drones do fly around in the sky, and they fly around at night. So it is possible. But drones have some fairly distinctive characteristics. Like when you see a plane fly across the sky, it's going to fly across basically in a straight line, maybe with a slight curve, but it doesn't stop. Drones can stop and they can hover in one spot. They can go vertically up and down. This is something that you don't see planes doing. You don't even see helicopters do that. So if you see that type of motion in an object, that kind of would lend you to the conclusion that it's probably a drone. And then the lighting configurations are going to be a bit different. You don't really have these widely spaced red and green lights that you have on planes, and you often just have a white light or a single green light or something like that.
I'm curious, it's just occurred to me now, are these sightings UFO sightings?
Well, any sighting that you see in the sky where you can't identify something is technically a UFO. People have mistakenly identified things as drones, but really they're UFOs because they don't actually know what they are. They're seeing lights in the sky and they're ascribing a cause to them, perhaps because they've got a cause. But what they're actually seeing is more likely things like high-altitude planes.
So, Mick, if the evidence is weak for these being drones, and, you know, some of the concerns that arose around drones, like surveillance and things like that, is there any reason to be concerned about drones generally? Are those fears or kind of those concerns that people have founded in anything at all?
Well, that's the thing. Drones are actually a real problem, and quite a large problem, and going to be a bigger problem in the future. Drones are a very easy way of transporting explosives from one location to another, and they're a very easy way of spying on things, like looking at things from the sky with a very high quality camera. So there's a real issue with security with drones, and you know, law enforcement needs to be vigilant because it's going to be something that will be increasingly a problem in the future. That's partly why this story got legs, is that it does represent a real thing, and the military acknowledges that it's a real issue. And when drones are seen over military bases, it's something they take very seriously. Unfortunately, though, we just kind of infected the public sphere, and we just got this vast amount of noise, which doesn't help. It's just a big distraction because, you know, well, we've got people, you know, shutting down airspace just because the public has been seeing planes above that airspace. It's not actually helping.
Finally, Mick, how did the drone story resolve? It seems to have kind of fallen out of the news cycle, at least for the time being. Is that because these mystery drones and lights have stopped flying over New Jersey, or is it possible just that attention has shifted elsewhere?
Well, there's been no change whatsoever in the amount of air traffic over New Jersey, and there's a hardcore group of people who are on the Mystery Jones of New Jersey Facebook group who are daily reporting these sightings of drones. However, there has been official statements now from, you know, the FBI and DHS who have basically explained what's going on. The vast majority of what people are seeing are just, you know, either normal drones or the mostly airplanes, and there isn't actually any need to be concerned. And so the media, you know, they take that at face value, you know, and it's also true, and they know that there's no actual story there, and they've had their own experiences. A lot of the media, they've gone out and they've gone studying car parks, and they've looked up in the sky, and they've seen things that they thought were drones, and then later on someone points out to them it was just a plane, and so they've got a little bit burnt there, so that they know there's really nothing there. But it hasn't gone away. There's still like a hardcore group of people, and there's like almost like a new subculture has emerged in ufology, that the people who think there is weird mystery drones. But in terms of a mainstream story, it's run its course.
Well, it seems like, you know, with people latching onto this, it likely will not be the last time that we have you on the show to talk about this. But I really do appreciate you taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Mick West is a skeptic who investigates conspiracy theories and UFO reports.
Mick says that we are witnessing the birth of a new UFO subculture. What might it have in common with the long history of UFO mythology?
What happens when we take a look at a phenomenon that has been strange, weird, spooky, odd, that also says something about the ways we think about science?
That's next. It's our regular look at critical thinking on big picture science. This episode is Skeptic Check, Drone Panic. Consternation over a flurry of mysterious flying objects is quite familiar to me, at least. As an astronomer with the SETI Institute, an organization that looks for evidence of alien life in the cosmos, I have long been the recipient of reports from the public in the form of phone calls, emails, people stopping me in the streets who hope that I can validate their apparent sightings of alien craft. And while I'm sympathetic, I have yet to see any evidence that we're being visited by aliens.
The parallels between decades of UFO sightings and the relatively recent drone phenomenon run deeper than the riddle of mysterious objects in the sky. They include how the objects were interpreted by the public, reported on by the headline-hungry press, and, to paraphrase Mark Twain, how rumor outpaced truth.
When we heard that Penn State historian Greg Agigian was writing a book about the history and psychology of UFOs, well, it was one arrival that we were pretty excited about. That book, When the Flying Saucers Came, A Global History of the UFO Phenomenon, has now landed.
Dr. Agigian covers the 1940s up to the recent reports when the term UAP, Unidentified Anomalous Phenomenon, replaced UFO. He recognizes the place that the recent drone craze has within the historic context of UFOs.
The two things have in common basically this idea of a high concentration of sightings over one general area. So that's what it would traditionally and classically be referred to in the UFO biz as a flap. That's a flap.
Well, let's look at the history of that, the history of UFO sightings, if you will. In your book, you say that you weren't really setting out to prove or disprove many of the claims about UFOs. What was your goal in writing this book then?
Yeah, so my goal was really to sit there and say, what happens, right, when we take a look at a phenomenon that has been a part of our popular culture and a part of, you have to say, even politics, right, for well over 70 years now, right, that is strange, weird, spooky, odd, kind of unexplainable at times, right, that also says something about the ways we think about science, right? How do we approach that and think about that in a way that doesn't get caught up in the same old stories that we've been hearing for really decades about, you know, did Roswell happen or didn't it happen? When we sort of approach it historically, what we see is it offers an opportunity to see the ways in which we have engaged historically with science and technology in a way, in other words, it reveals a lot about the ways we think about ourselves, less than it does about what we think about aliens.
But isn't it true that, indeed, the association with aliens wasn't the first explanation for these sightings, right? I mean, many people thought it was just all related to the Pentagon or maybe the Soviets in the early days, that this was some sort of military phenomenon.
why is it that the emphasis switched to alien?
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that I think those two things do actually feed off of one another to a large extent, right? The idea of that whatever is being seen, and we can talk about this as something that was there in the early days in the 1940s or something you're seeing since 2017, it's all the same in the sense that the thing that gives this coverage, that gives this media attention, but is seen as therefore worthy of legitimate concern among politicians, right, is this idea of threat to national security. But the threat to national security in turn also provides a way for people who are interested in promoting the idea that this is really about aliens, it gives them a way of saying, hey, ultimately this is what this is about, right? Let's not drop the ball here. Let's take this stuff seriously, because at the very least you're going to find national security issues that are worthy of investigation. So both sides of those things, I think, kind of feed off of one another, but you're quite right. The thing that mostly captures the attention, I think, of the general public is this possibility, is this prospect that these are extraterrestrials.
When were they first described as looking like, you know, saucers? When did that begin?
That begins the summer of 1947. It begins when this guy, Kenneth Arnold, right, who's a private pilot in June of 1947, is flying around Mount Rainier, says he sees these sort of he first described them as pie pan shaped objects, 9 of them flying in formation, never seen anything like it. They're moving at incredible speeds. And that's where this idea of the pie pan shaped kind of object starts to be described, when he ends up sort of telling reporters about it, an enterprising journalist comes up with this term, flying saucer. And that's then throughout the rest of the summer of 1947, there are hundreds of reports across America by ordinary civilians of people saying they saw flying saucers. Though usually, if you look more carefully at the records, it pretty much indicates that most people are actually describing seeing odd lights. That's oftentimes what people describe. But they usually get pigeonholed as saucers.
The period you cover in your book, Greg, extends from the first UFO sightings in the mid-1940s, late-1940s until now. Can you give a couple of examples of maybe cultural turning points or important moments during this history?
Sure. I'd say the first big moment after that initial sighting and that initial wave of reports in 1947 is 1950. 1950 is when this fellow by the name of Donald Kehoe, first of all, writes an article and then publishes soon after that a book called The Flying Saucers Are Real. He's a retired military man, but he'd been writing pulp fiction for quite some time after retiring. He sort of sees himself as an investigative reporter, talks to his contacts in the Defense Department, who tell him that the United States government and intelligence officials in the Air Force are actually looking into these flying saucer sightings. And he then reports that they have come to the conclusion that two things are happening, that the military thinks A, these things are extraterrestrial, and B, they're not going to reveal that to the general public because their fear is that they will provoke a mass panic. And so that story, that sort of narrative makes its way into the general public. His book is a bestseller. It gets serialized all across the world. So it gets translated into all these languages. So within just the span of just a few months, that storyline, those two storylines, the military thinks UFOs are extraterrestrial, and then you get this other line that they're keeping it a secret. Those two things are really planted into people's minds, and that becomes, right, really the modern UFO phenomenon. Those two narratives become really, I think, formative in how we think about UFOs.
So, Greg, we all know about the hysteria, though the hysteria has largely been overstated, I think, with the Orson Welles broadcast of War of the Worlds at the end of the 1930s. What about the 1950s in America? Were people going nuts about alien visitors?
I think hysteria is, you're quite right, hysteria is overblown as a term to refer to the War of the Worlds and the reception to it in 1938. And I think the same holds true about UFOs. The term, calling it a craze, right, seems to sort of indicate that people were, you know, jumping out of windows, packing up the kids, moving to the mountains, things like that. That really doesn't happen. You have a few isolated instances where people say, they got overly, you know, they encountered somebody who seemed like they were overwrought about these things. I would say actually the reaction that made it really a craze was less fear than enthusiasm. It was excitement. It was about getting involved and maybe spotting one of these things. I think of one event in particular caught my eye I think it was in the 1950s, of a local radio station in Indiana that basically held a kind of a one-night sort of UFO sighting night, right? Everybody in the community, get out there, get out your binoculars, get on the roof, see if you see anything, and if so, report it to our station. We'll send it off to the local Air Force base. We have hotlines ready for you to report stuff. Hundreds of people reported things. There even was a group of people who assembled over what then was called Notre Dame Stadium, right? And they had telescopes and I think things like that set up for observations, and people got together. Hundreds of people got together at the stadium to observe this stuff. So the kind of craze really was less about people getting really, really overwrought and fraught and worried about things than it was about this prospect that maybe they were going to see something pretty incredible.
You also cite societal fears that were driving the UFO craze, certainly in the 1950s, nuclear weapons, nuclear war, that kind of thing. What might be the cultural anxiety driving the interest, the current interest, in these drone sightings, or is it just the same phenomenon?
Well, yeah, you know, I think there are, you know, sort of broad and deep sets of concerns that are sort of being expressed in all of this stuff. And a lot of that is what we've been seeing, say, over the last 5 to 7 years now, right? Once we had this sort of new wave of interest, that's this kind of resurgence or revival of interest in UFOs. And I think a lot of that comes from a number of different things. One is this sense and this recognition that the United States is slowly losing ground, or this feeling that the United States is losing ground to Russia, China in particular, when it comes to both commercial enterprises in the case of China, but in both cases when it comes to the technologies of surveillance. This sense that they have technologies, or they potentially have technologies that we don't yet have, that we've got to be worried about them, that we know they're spying on us, that they're up to no good when it comes to playing around with our elections and playing around with disinformation. So I think there's a lot of that concern being expressed. I think the other part of it is this newfound excitement about things like drone technologies, but also the concerns that come with that, which is this inherent idea that people of all ilks, from, you know, your neighbor down the road to somebody two villages down the road, might be able to spy and look in on you. All of those things, I think, are at work in this kind of concern and this kind of wave of concern and fears about drones.
So, Greg, you mentioned in your book that, you know, whether or not the UFO phenomenon has anything to do with aliens, it does tell us something about humans. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, it tells us a lot of different things, but I'd say one of the biggest takeaways about this is that what the UFO thing has done, right, because of this idea that these are potentially extraterrestrial visitors, right? In other words, they must be extremely advanced. They are, in a sense, if they are visiting us, or even if we imagine them as a possibility, they must be so advanced technologically, scientifically, culturally, that they, in a sense, offer us a vision of our own future. And I think one of the things that strikes me about what you see in the UFO phenomenon as a social phenomenon is a constant discussion and debate about what science and technology is and what it should be and maybe what it shouldn't be. Because what it did, the UFO phenomenon has always done, is offer an opportunity to have this kind of debate and discussion about, you know, are science and technology going to save us? Or are they actually the thing that's going to pose the greatest menace to us, right? And UFOs were a way to have that conversation without actually having it directly. And I think that in that sense, it's been very, very revelatory.
How do you maintain a healthy skepticism in situations like this? And not so much skepticism that you're, you know, shutting yourself off from what may be very interesting ideas or news. You know, it's okay to be skeptical about the government, but on the other hand, sometimes the government is telling you the truth. What's the way back?
Yeah, the way back. That's the tough thing. I think the big thing is, and this is what you might expect from a historian, is to take a deep breath. Don't get caught up in hype. Don't feel you have to react to something immediately, right? Avoid the thumbs up, thumbs down approach to information that comes your way. The key thing for me is to take the long view about things. That knowledge is not the same as information. Information isn't the same as knowledge. Knowledge comes through a slow process of moving through the information, looking at it carefully to decipher, does some stuff triangulate well with other information? Does this information, however, come from a questionable source? All that hard work has to come in. It's not a terribly exciting way of doing things. It's the way, however, academics like me do it. So I'd say it's about taking things slow. It's slow cooking is the way to approach it.
Well, Greg Gagin, thank you so very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Greg Gagin is a professor of history and bioethics at Penn State University, and he is the author of After the Flying Saucers Came, A Global History of the UFO Phenomenon. Well, this brings us to the big picture thoughts in the show, and we'll start with the conclusion to the story that we told at the beginning of the episode. That is, that of the Seattle windshield pitting epidemic of 1954 in Bellingham, Washington. Well, this is how that resolved. After that frantic month, it went away. People stopped reporting the dings in their windshield and the panic evaporated. There was never an explanation for the supposed increase in the appearance of dings in windshields, but it has been attributed to the power of suggestion, that people suddenly started noticing something that had been there all along. Well, now we turn to producer Brian Edwards, who worked closely on this episode, and Seth Shostak, of course. What are your big picture thoughts in this episode about drones?
I found it interesting, Seth, that when people were given answers by experts, it fueled their skepticism anyways, and it makes me think that this is an example of the big decline in trust that people have in experts and their expertise, and how being too skeptical can actually get in the way of the truth.
You're absolutely right, Brian. I think a lot of this goes back to the 40s and 50s when, the government was being disingenuous about what really was in the sky, and that was because a lot of it had to do with the Department of Defense, and it was, you know, it was kept secret for a good reason.
I think if we're tossing a little bit of blame out to groups that have historically done a poor job of communicating this information to the public, I can't help but think of how the media has treated this as well. How many of these stories now, and I'm sure you have examples in the past of reporters being very excited to cover these when people say they're UFOs, but once we know they're planes, maybe that's not quite the same story anymore.
This show is thanks to the well-identified and documented talents of senior producer Gary Niederhoff and assistant producers Brian Edwards and Shannon Rose Geary. I am Molly Bentley, the executive producer for Big Picture Science.
And I'm Seth Shostak, senior astronomer at the SETI Institute. We'd like to give a big thanks to our listeners and to our Patreon supporters.
The original music in the show is by Dewey DeLay and June Miyake.
This episode of Big Picture Science, our regular look at critical thinking, suggests rational explanations for strange objects in the sky and is called Skeptic Check, Drone Panic. Skeptic Check is brought to you thanks to a generous grant from the Trimberger Family Foundation. At the Trimberger Family Foundation, we hold that skepticism is a lamp that lights the way to truth. You don't need to be a scientist to hold that lamp. Look for evidence. Keep on thinking. Trimberger.org.
KSDP is generously supported by Precision Airways in Sandpoint, Alaska, offering chartered air services throughout the Aleutians Eastborough and beyond. For more information on charters and prices, Theo is available at 907-989-4080. Precision Airways is a proud sponsor of KSDP.
When the little bluebird, who has never said a word, starts to sing, spring, spring. When the little blue bell in the bottom of the dell starts to ring, ding, ding. When the little blue clerk in the middle